The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel is Reese Davis.
The Cats hope to catch the Vols looking ahead. Is TCU getting the credit it deserves? And is Big Brother finally going to lay the hammer to the thorn in their side? This is the College Game Day podcast for Wednesday, October 26th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel. We are just under 1 week until the unveiling of the first college football playoff rankings. So by definition, everyone in the sport was glued to the television last night at 7 o'clock Eastern time when Kirk Herbstreit, David Pollack, Joey Galloway, and me, along with a surprise appearance from Chris Felica, got people ready for the rankings. And everyone who was serious about the sport and authority on the sport, as it were, You were tuned in, right, Pete? So what was your favorite part of the college football playoff top 25 ranking show last night?
you didn't give it away well with the giggle at the end there, Reese. So there was a distinct choice in the Thamel household on Tuesday night after young Teddy went to bed and settled in for some evening television. There was Reese Davis smiling on the YouTube menu, like ready to be clicked upon to watch. And then I said, can I really explain to my wife that this isn't the rankings, but it's the show before the rankings? Like when I go to conventions and they're not athletic director conventions, but the people are going to become them. She's like, wait a minute. So they're not even like the real ones. And so sometimes it just things with Kate, who works in fashion and maybe doesn't follow our sport with the fervor as many of our listeners. So we went and watched The Watcher. We made a decision. I made a business decision, a Tuesday night decision to watch The Watcher, which is the Netflix show about it's like a thriller about a couple of moves into a home in New Jersey and gets harassed by an anonymous mailer. And it's quite good. I recommended it to our colleague, Gene Wojciechowski. I will gently tease that Gene will be in the home of an FBS coach on game day this week who is alleged to have a haunted house, and Gene may have ghost hunters with him. So, and we could lose Gene to like the new iteration of Unsolved Mysteries. We should be worried because I think Gene is really going to crush that role. So The Watcher is great, by the way. Rob agrees with me. I don't know if Sarah or Charles have come and joined the Watcher party yet, but it's quite good. So, with all apologies, I do have your banter saved in my YouTube archives to watch on the way to Jackson.
We had a good time. It was a good show, but I think you could spend your time more wisely on your way to Jackson. Probably, I mean, it's the show before the show, you know. I mean, it was some of the stuff that you would expect. We talked about the differences between Tennessee and Georgia, how you were separating them, Ohio State, Michigan, who might get left out if TCU and Clemson run the table, you know, TCU passing Clemson, all of that. All of those things are really important and are the focus of this podcast. But I haven't had the opportunity yet to meet your lovely wife, Kate. But you said something that piqued my interest.
Yeah,
you said she worked in the fashion industry.
Yes.
How so? Because now you're talking, Pete. I want to hear about this.
She's a fashion buyer for the TJX company, Reese.
Okay. Does she dabble into men's fashion?
So she's done a lot of different things over the years, but it's mostly women's fashion. So she does dabble in my fashion. Don't judge her on it. I've come a long way.
I think you've done a great job. You've done a great job out there.
I would not, as you wanted to have a pocket square with your toga in Eugene, I probably wouldn't be that fashion forward.
I think the thing is I've really leaned into this much like the entire thing about dressing well to fly on a plane. I am serious about that. I am sick and tired of, you know, people looking like they just finished cleaning their garage. I mean, I don't really think yeah, that you have
I don't,
to dress
I don't
up.
Ride with you on, I don't ride with you on that one.
Yeah, I know you don't, but I've really leaned into it, and probably I shouldn't even say this because people stop doing it, and I get a great kick out of it. But I have one of our executives that was supposed to be on a flight with me, ended up not going. It was one that got canceled last week to Eugene or whatever. But he texted me the night before to apologize in advance for his attire on the plane. So I've actually quite enjoyed the banter back and forth and making fun of people to a degree that it really doesn't even bother me, but it does kind of. I mean, I'll confess, there was a gentleman who was not well dressed on a flight with Jen Latta and me last week, and the dress, as it turns out, was the least of his concerns. He had all kinds of very loud issues on the way flying. I mean, there was wailing and banging and gyrating and then loud laughter. I don't know what was going on there, but you know, perhaps it was because he realized how poorly dressed he was. But I don't want to, you know, make fun because I don't know what all was going on, but none of the flight attendants ever really went over to see him. So it couldn't have been too serious. He was just, he was a little sideways. We'll put it that way. And that's putting it mildly. I'm sure Latta's talked about it on her morning radio show because she'll talk about anything on that show. One other, you know, we're going to Jackson this week to go to the Boombox Classic. We got some really cool stuff put together on the subject of executives. I know that just like you haven't been held captive by our Tuesday night ranking show, I'm sure you're not locked in on my Twitter feed either, which, you know, I've really tried to break this habit that I hear a lot, Pete, of people saying, well, I posted this on social media, I posted that on social media, blah, blah. But there was a thing this week where some people got upset because I quoted the Johnny Cash, June Carter classic, Jackson, in a tweet and became upset to some degree because they alleged that the song was about Jackson, Tennessee, and not Jackson, Mississippi, including one of our executives, the very talented and excellent leader, Stephanie Drewley, who tweeted and said, I think this song is about Jackson, Tennessee. To which then I responded with a direct quote from the songwriter himself, who said, it's not about any particular Jackson. I like the sharp, hard consonant sounds of Jackson, as opposed to the softer sounds like, say, let's say Nashville. So I enjoy every now and then getting to tell the suits that they ought to trust me. You know,
so Jackson's like Springfield in The Simpsons.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of
in every town.
Yeah. What's the town in Family Guy? We forget how to pronounce it. Quahog or
Quahog.
Quahog. Okay. Yeah.
Quahog.
Quahog.
Quahog. Quahog. Right.
Thank you, funny. Taylor.
My son tells me that there is a Family Guy clip for every situation, and it is really remarkable. Because I'm not an aficionado, but I've watched it quite a bit.
It's funny. Yeah.
It is very funny. Yeah. And so I've watched it some, and we'll sometimes as a family, some subject will come up just randomly. And my son will pop up this Family Guy clip. It's really pretty amazing.
That's the magic of YouTube now. You just you don't have to quote it. You can actually just like pull your phone up and 30 seconds later you can play it for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we're looking forward to going to Jackson. Now, what are you most looking forward to about that trip down there?
So a couple things. I've never been to a big HBCU game, so I'm excited to sort of, you know, engage in the pageantry and, you know, just sort of see the scene. I think it's going to be remarkable. I am taking a little side trip Thursday night to go to the Southern Miss Louisiana game in Hattiesburg, and I'm excited about that. I have never been to a game at the Rock. It's about an hour 20. 6:30 kick local. So when I land, I'm just going to scoot right down and see our friends at Southern Miss. So that should be a fun little side trip. I have not been to a Thursday game this year, and I always like going to Thursday games. There's lots of scouts there, and there'll be a good buzz in the air. Will Hall, you know, they have Tulane's only loss. They delivered to them earlier this year. They've got a good little buzz going in their second season, and Louisiana's turned things around after a tough start under Mike Desmo. So I'm a sucker for weeknight football, and I get to catch a little live, so I'm pretty fired up about that. And I'll be curious just about Coach Prime. I haven't spent a lot of time around him. I've not covered the NFL, so he was obviously in college long before I started covering college. So yeah, I'll just kind of be curious. I saw Dez on his social media was down there with him this week. Mm-hmm. Did they play together somewhere?
Let's see. Dez was with the Redskins and the Packers, and I think the Raiders. So I don't think so. Either. I don't think so. But yeah.
But I'd be curious. Yeah, I'll just kind of be curious because look, like we're getting a window, Reese, into what a lot of schools are thinking about. Right? Mm-hmm. People have been curious and will continue to be curious. Like when people bring up Jackson this week on the phone, the first question is he going to get a job? Is Dan going to get a job? Is someone going to grab it? Like that is like the on the tip of people's tongues. And so I think getting to see his program up close, getting to see what he's built. I think they have a Friday morning practice that if it doesn't conflict with our meetings, then I'm going to try to go over to and see. I'd be with you on that.
I'd like to do that too. Maybe we might have to move a meeting. I'm really curious.
They've got Tim Brewster's on their staff, the former Minnesota coach. He's the tight ends coach. Dennis Thurman, longtime NFL defensive coordinator, former USC assistant back in the day, former USC player, I believe. Dion has assembled a good staff, and there's some talented guys. So I'm actually going to dig in a little bit today with scouts on. They have some portal guys who are getting looks. They don't have like a top 100 player there in this upcoming draft, but they have some talent. So I'm just kind of curious. I'm going to call Willie Simmons at FAMU, who played him earlier this year. And obviously they thumped him in the Orange Blossom Classic down there in South Florida. That was when FAMU was getting all their guys back off the, remember they had all the suspensions for the opener against Carolina, eligibility issues.
Correct. There.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just kind of curious to eyeball, you and I've done this for a long time. We say that all the time in here, right? There's not a lot of like firsts left. There's not a lot of things I haven't done left. So this is a really cool one. So I'm pretty fired up.
I have been able to cover big HBCU games in the past. In addition, we took the show there for week zero a couple of years ago, I guess last year. Time starts melding together. But when I was working in local, Tuskegee and Morehouse used to play in Columbus, Georgia, where I worked. And that was always like a huge scene, an intense game, fun game, to go check out. So I'm looking forward to seeing all of the things you mentioned as well. And Jacob Hester, who's now a radio host, told me earlier this week that played at LSU, played in the pros, for a long time. That the facilities, he said, you'll be blown away, be really impressed with the facilities that that Jackson State has put together with Deion Sanders urging, and push forward to be able to do that. He said they've really got excellent facilities for their players, and so I'm excited about going as well. I hope it's not pouring down rain. Pouring down rain in the show, I don't think it's going to dampen the enthusiasm of the show, but, hopefully not for the game that it won't be that. I hope it's not for the show either, particularly.
I haven't looked at the forecast.
90% at last check. Hopefully that's going to change. It wasn't as rainy as anticipated last week in Eugene, so we could be good there.
We got like six weather patterns in one day in Eugene. So.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, it's 100% now. So
is it?
Okay, yeah, well, it's just a matter of when it comes, I guess.
Okay, so, well, make sure you.
That
got
could be a pretty fun boots. Scene in the pouring rain with some bands.
Could be,
and I'm curious about the fans. I have no sense. Obviously, the HBCU schools have passionate fans, right? Like that's one of the things you can, when you watch those games on TV, you can feel that viscerally. So I'll be curious the type of energy they bring to the show.
I think it's going to be huge. From what I understand, the whole city is really excited about us coming. Some have even compared it to the excitement that we felt when we went to Memphis, when the entire city sort of got behind the arrival. And I'm going to look it up right now. The capacity at the vet at Mississippi Veterans Memorial Stadium is like 60,000. And I think they're expecting more along the lines of 70,000. thousand at the game. Yeah. So it's and I imagine with it being, you know, an afternoon kick, the kick doesn't bump up against the show, but it's not long thereafter. And apparently, sure. You know, the tailgating and preparation, everything is going to be right there beside our set. And yeah. you brought up something really interesting, and then we'll move on to the week after this. You brought up the point that everybody that you've talked to has asked, Is Deion going to get a job? And we often say on College Game Day that we don't always just go to the game where the two highest ranked teams are playing against each other. And I think we've really underscored that this year, mm-hmm. that we follow things that are stories and big scenes. Appalachian State at the time, coming off that wild game against Carolina, the upset against Texas A&M, they were a story for the first, you know, 2 weeks of the season. They had sort of captured the imagination of people. Kansas with the unbeaten start in a big conference showdown. Never been there. That was a story in the moment. And I think because of what Deion's built, both with the success that Jackson State is having on the field and his attractiveness as a potential head coach elsewhere, should he choose to pursue that path. And he's one of the few guys in the industry, I would say, that has the means and the stature and the credibility in terms of accomplishment to where he doesn't have to if he doesn't want to. It's a question of whether he wants to and how that dovetails with what he perceives as his mission, as his ministry, you know, all of those things that he's talked about extensively. So we're following the story, and I think it's going to be a great scene.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
Throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
I don't think the slate is heavy with tremendous games. And there are a lot of questions, I think, about where, even at home, even in front of the big crowd, about whether Penn State can really push or be a threat to Ohio State. I do think it might be one of the better tests for Ohio State's defense for the first time this season, but I'm not sure. I'm not really sure that they have enough offensively to keep up with whatever Ohio State's going to do to just about anybody.
Yeah, you know, you got to give Brian Hartline, the receivers coach at Ohio State, a lot of credit. Like, he has crafted a room where the single best, most productive receiver in the country, Jackson Smith and Jigba, who had the best receiving year in the history of the Big Ten in 2021, can essentially be lost for the season. Now, I hope his hamstring is back. It certainly didn't look good the way he pulled up against Iowa early in the second quarter on Saturday. But just the fact that they have essentially seamlessly evolved without him. Now, they certainly miss him. He's the best receiver in the country. He's a top 10 NFL draft pick. He had, what, 347 receiving yards in the Rose Bowl? I mean, mm-hmm. it was a Rose Bowl record. It was a bowl record, and I believe it was the fifth best single game performance. It was against Utah, too, a team that has a pass rush and, you know, has Clark Phillips and others at corner, although Phillips might not have played in that game. The fact that they have been able to build that group and build that culture to where essentially you don't get on the field and start if you're not a first rounder is fairly remarkable. And look, Alabama had that for about a 3-year stretch, and that is ended, right? I mean, we can say that with some comfort. They have good players.
Yeah.
And they have players who are going to develop into good players, but they don't have an all SEC wide receiver right now at Alabama. And that shows, that they lead the nation in drops. It just shows in a little bit of the clunkiness of their offense. When you don't have that type of dynamism, in fact, their, you know, all American receiver last year came from Ohio State, which may be the mm-hmm. highest compliment you could have. So that group, I will say this, goofy things happen at Penn State at night, right? I think about the...
Yeah, it's a noon game though.
I'm sorry. It is a big... Yeah. Now, if I'm James Franklin, I would hate that. Like that place at night is a cauldron, and it'll be great at noon because it's Penn State and it's a whiteout. But boy, that place at night is, there's some of the great scenes I've ever covered college football in have happened in Penn State at night. The scene will be Ohio State's by far and away biggest test of the year. What is Penn State's run defense? Is it what it was the first 6 weeks of the season, or was it Michigan mauling over them as they did? And I was surprised by that. How do their freshman tailbacks hold up against arguably the best defense they're going to see this year? Is Ohio State's defensive line evolved to the point where they can be definitive run stuffers? It's almost for Ohio State a little bit of like the tests you're going to have at the end of the year at Michigan. These are the quizzes, and then we're going to get a check in to see how you perform against it.
The Penn State Michigan game, it can be overly influential in evaluating this game. But I came away from that, yes, a little bit cooled on Penn State, but more impressed with Michigan. More so that, you know what? They probably, I wouldn't go in and pick them to beat Ohio State at the end of the season in Columbus. But I did come away from that game and putting 400 yards on the ground on, what had been a really good rush defense and maybe still is for Penn State. I came away from that game more along the lines of thinking, all right, Michigan's not just going to roll over and act as if last year was a one-year aberration in the Ohio State dominance. Ohio State probably will beat them, probably should beat them, but they're going to have to do it. They're going to have to play well. They won't be able to, roll out an average game and beat them. At least, your perceptions evolve as the season goes along. But I came away from that game not so much down on Penn State, other than throwing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at guys allegedly, and more impressed with Michigan. In case you don't know that story, this week during the news conferences and talking to the Michigan players about the little and Harbaugh. About the little dust up in the tunnel. Most of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the Big House. The two teams go into one tunnel in one side, and it can lead to some unpleasantries from time to time. And it did at halftime of the Penn State Michigan game. And I guess it was RJ Moten who told a teammate, I just got hit in the face with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So I don't know who would throw a good PB&J, but apparently someone did.
I mean, you're giving away halftime protein, right? Like, that's gonna keep you fueled in the second half. Yeah, big house, small tunnel, right? That's the lesson of the lesson of this. Good old fashioned coach chippiness too. Nothing wrong with that, right? Nothing wrong with coaches just straight out calling each other, saying the stuff they would like call their conference football administrator and complain about. Saying it out loud is just beautiful. It like never changed Jim Harbaugh.
I tell you, I agree. Because Harbaugh said that it looked as if, paraphrasing here, that James Franklin was the ringleader of the whole thing. He said, and by the way, I've got bigger fish to fry than that kind of whining. I think he referred to them as sophomoric.
That was a nice pull, showing off his Michigan degree.
Yeah, or his time at Stanford. But probably the Michigan degree. I don't want to insult the good people at Michigan, but it was.
Well, he did when he was at Stanford, actually, because he said they didn't have any academic standards. And then he
True. That's true. So I guess I'm in the clear there. But yeah, I love that stuff. I like to do those coach translators every now and then. It's one thing I really miss about Mark D'Antonio not being at Michigan State anymore, because I mean, his disdain and contempt for the maize and blue always showed through, a good fodder for the translator, that everything that came out of his mouth and Harbaugh's in retort was almost basically, I don't like them. I think one year I played this long D'Antonio bite, it came out and said, yeah, what he says is, I hate Michigan, which is pretty much it. That game, Michigan State, for whatever reason, I know the reason, at least a large part of it. For Michigan, Michigan State is largely an annoyance. Over the years. I mean, I'm speaking historically way back. Ohio State's their biggest rival. That gets under Michigan State's skin, of course. So for Michigan State, it's a crusade. For Michigan, it's a little bit more of a relief type thing. But it might be, you know, it might be different this year because, you know, I think since 2008, old Sparty's 10-4 against Michigan. Mel Tucker, Tuck coming, you know, Tuck's coming. He's 2-0 against them. And Michigan State all time. This is a really a fascinating nugget. They have 11 wins as an unranked team against ranked Michigan teams. Wow. That is the most such wins by one program over a single opponent in the history of the AP poll.
Wow.
11. They live to ruin things for their neighbors to the south.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment in time for Michigan State. I have to admit, I did a little bit of a double take that was the primetime game on ABC. And it'll rate big. People care. It's a great rivalry. It's just again credit at Michigan State after just a interminable 4-game slog. You know, including just the game they didn't show up at Maryland, which was probably the most surprising. You know, they have homecoming against Wisconsin and they beat them in double overtime. And so if you're Michigan State staff right now, you know Mel Tucker's not going anywhere, right? So you're coaching for your job. Because there will be changes. As the head coach isn't going anywhere. It's the same thing with Jimbo Fisher down at Texas A&M. Obviously, you know, he is completely safe. There's zero chance he's going to go, just like Mel Tucker. But you've hit a dip, and the university is committed historically to you if you're Mel Tucker. Now you have to show you can fix it. And, you know, the portal giveth, but the portal also may not. And I think that's the lesson of Mel Tucker here. And what I'd be concerned about if I were a Michigan State fan is, where are the guys you recruited in your first class, which again was COVID, right? So it's hard. But like when are the guys going to start to show and flash? Are the building blocks there? And I think this game is a good test of that for Mel Tucker, because I do think that we'll see some changes pretty significantly on both sides of the ball. I do think they probably got a little too portal reliant. And that's a balance when you talk to coaches that they're dealing with all the time. And now that there are holes, clearly, now you've got to fill them immediately. You don't have the time to grow and develop. Mel Tucker, I mean, made his bones in the SEC for years and other places like Ohio State when he wasn't in the NFL, you know, as someone who was an elite recruiter. He saw the Kirby machine and helped run it. He saw the Nick machine and helped run it. I'd like to see their machine kick up. Their machine meaning high school recruiting.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough spot because I don't think they're ever going to consistently beat Ohio State, Michigan, but they should be right there on some, maybe get a few wins here and there. And I sort of think he, in this, unless, you know, the portal rules change, he's always going to have to rely on the portal to some degree. But being overly reliant is difficult because this is different from basketball. I heard a college basketball coach the other day say just openly and candidly that I don't worry about who might leave or who might come. I take my team this year, 1 year experience, and realize it is going to be totally different next year. And I don't think you can do that in football because you're dealing with more people. I think the nature of the sport often lends itself to more need for continuity from 1 year to the next, at least some continuity. But I do think that they're always going to have major blocks from the portal because I don't think they're going to win that level of recruiting battle if they want to compete with Michigan and Ohio State particularly, and maybe you could even extend that to Penn State.
And when you look at the rest of their schedule, they're at Illinois, Rutgers at home, Indiana at Penn State. If they lose, as Vegas dictates, I believe, by 3 touchdowns that they will on Saturday, they will go to 3-5. So that means, obviously, they would have to finish 3-1 in those final 4 games. I have a hard time seeing that happening. So I think that we will start to see a November of soul searching and change in East Lansing.
Well, they're not winning Saturday night. I'll tell you that right now. And I'm considering on Friday, considering making this my lock, because we've seen Harbaugh, and I don't think that he's that different from the, hey, what's your deal? And going for two, make a statement, you know, against SC back when he was at Stanford. This has been a little bit of a thorn in his side, right? Whether it's these two games, whether it's the botched punt snap, you know, all of those things, you know, that have sort of been the thorn in the side of Jim Harbaugh. If they get a chance to lay the number, I think they lay the number, and I suspect that they will do just that.
Yeah, I don't see Sparty putting up a lot of resistance. But
no.
When D'Antonio was there, there were a lot of times when I didn't see them putting up resistance, and they figured out a way. So
blind hatred will carry you a long way sometimes.
Yes, God bless it. Yes, God bless it. But I don't see us, locked in for is Herbie calling that game?
No, he's not. Which that what a segue artist you've become. Beautiful. Kirk is calling the Kentucky-Tennessee game on Saturday night on
Very
Rocky
nice.
Top.
Very which nice. You sure you got a condo in Knoxville this year.
I know. How about that? It's been there quite a bit. Game day's been there twice. It might not be his last trip there. Who knows with the way the season is unfolding. Do you know that this is just the third time that they've ever met as ranked opponents?
Wow.
Would you like to hazard to guess who the coaches were the last time Kentucky and Tennessee met as ranked opponents?
Bear Bryant for Kentucky. And then General Nealon for Tennessee.
Excellent work by you, Peter Thamel. Wow. Excellent work by you.
I'm paying some Tennessee taxes this year too.
So. Yeah. this is the quintessential battle of style and pace. There are a couple of things. Tennessee historically has absolutely owned Kentucky. Mark Stoops has had a little bit of success, but overall Tennessee, despite all of its issues, they've won 34 of 37 in this meeting. You have one of the slowest paced teams in the country in Kentucky and one of the fastest in Tennessee. The one thing I wonder about is last year, it was first year, I get it. Tennessee's offensive line is probably even better this year. Kentucky did get a little pressure on Hendon Hooker last year, which was something Alabama was unable to do this year. For Kentucky to have any chance, and I'm not sure that I believe they really do have a chance, but to have any chance, that's what they have to do. I think I've got the number here. They pressured him on 36% of his dropbacks last year. That's the most he's been pressured in any start at Tennessee. And he got sacked 5 times. He went 2 for 5 with averaged about 5 yards per attempt. Now, he cut him up when he wasn't pressured, as he has just about everybody else. That's their only chance, is to somehow get them behind the sticks, make a couple of unproductive possessions, and then hog the ball and be able to control the pace and the tempo and maybe hit some shots with Levis, who seems to be getting healthier. But I'm not optimistic about the Wildcats' chances to catch the balls in a look-ahead game, looking ahead to Georgia.
You know, it's interesting, Reese. So to tease a digital story I'll be doing next week, I've been talking to coaches for the past 4 or 5 days to kind of, you know, these anonymous breakdown stories where you kind of got guys.
I love those.
Yeah, and this one's been particularly fun because, you know, there are years where it's like, oh, Alabama, they're really good. You know, their left guard might be a little shaky, but like, you know, there were, you had to really search for vulnerabilities, where I think one of the things that's making this season unfold so fascinating is that everybody's got some vulnerabilities up top, right? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's running away with anything this year. And I think that the ceiling that Alabama and Georgia had pushed maybe and nudged away from the sport has come down to, you know, numbers 3 versus 7 or 3 versus 8. I do think there's a beautiful muddle one to at least 6 at the top of the sport. So I will tease this. Boy, do a lot of coaches think Tennessee can beat Georgia, like way more than I thought. The people who sat in the film room and grinded it out. So I certainly have a lot of respect for Kentucky. And the reason you said is this: the teams that can affect Hooker are going to have the best chance to beat them. Jalen Carter really just hasn't been a factor this year for Georgia. So
he's been hurt a lot.
And he had the MCL against Missouri. Kirby's pessimistic about him playing this week. I probably wouldn't expect him to in the cocktail party. Maybe he's back for Tennessee. Maybe he isn't. But so it will be interesting to see. That was a dogfight in Lexington last year. Tennessee won by a field goal, 45-42. How much better is Tennessee, you know, on offense where they could maybe push ahead? There's an expectation that Cedric Tillman comes back, which I think has been it, you know, amid this glorious run for Tennessee, they have not had their best player. Like, he is their best draft prospect on the offense. And so all of a sudden, again, they should not look past Kentucky, because Kentucky has the war daddies up front who could impact Hooker, and obviously has from the data you gave last year. But boy, is it going to be a fun one. We can dive into that more next week a little bit. But I did. It was surprising, because it was like, you know, Georgia, especially at corner opposite Ringo, people are very skeptical. If there's one thing we saw, I mean, we saw Helms, the safety from Alabama, just you could feel like viscerally him getting exposed in that game. He knew it. 100,000 people in Neyland Stadium knew it. If there is someone to expose in a secondary, Alex Golish and Josh Heupel have shown they can call the plays and dial it up to figure it out.
You know, and that's the thing, not to go back to that game, but that was the big coaching win. That was the pantsing of the Alabama defensive staff, was that they kept finding him. Really interesting, too, that led Alabama to put Eli Ricks on the field for the mm-hmm. first time. Maybe, you know, there were some practice issues or whatever, but he looked like a dude against Mississippi State.
Yeah, that's been an interesting case.
Yeah. I would hazard to guess that old number 7 is going to be out there for the rest of the year, barring some unfortunate circumstance.
SEC title game, I guarantee
you. Oh, yeah. It'll have to be. Alabama's got a couple of big hurdles to get to that SEC title game. Doubt. All of their tough games are on the road this year, and they turned the A&M game into a tough one at home. But one thing I'd like to hear, we don't have to dive into it now, but for next week, if you still have some more guys to talk to, mm-hmm. pressure on Hooker. Schematically, what did Alabama not do that maybe Georgia will learn from and do to free up some of their pass rushers? Because it never really seemed as if they got, very often anyway, got Turner, Anderson, obviously, Braswell, loose to try to say, go get him. And I would be interested to hear that.
Well, I don't think they did much. That was basically generally, they just kind of sat back and hoped Will got home, and then didn't make a ton of adjustments in between to try to change that to affect him. Because for Hooker, and look, he's the Heisman leader. I don't want to knock Hendon Hooker at all, but he is not Drew Brees' accuracy. So the mm-hmm. thought is, if you can close into him and close the windows, that's the best way to get them behind the chains. To slow them down, you have to get them behind the chains. And so what's interesting, another coach pointed out to me, Reese, in that line, is that if you are Georgia, you are happy they had Alabama first, because mm-hmm. your systems are so similar that you can glean from what they did wrong. It's almost like you played them twice, right? You don't have film of yourself. It's a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's enough schematic overlays of what worked and what didn't, where you get to drill down on what worked.
Can't you just hear Herb Street right now, if he were sitting on here with us? Poor old Kentucky. Poor old Mark Stoops. I don't even know why they're going to bother to show up. I don't know. Yeah. So
poor old Will Levis, maybe the number one pick in the draft.
Number one pick in the draft. No chance, no shot. I mean, all he did was throw for 372 yards on him last year. And you can move the ball through the air on Tennessee's defense. And Chris Rodriguez is coming off his best game of the season, almost 200 yards on the ground. So, you know.
Wonder how many scouts will be in old Lexington. I think Bear said last week that Keeneland closed. That's too bad, because there could have been a boon from the scouting community over there.
You know, it's and this is a big opportunity, too. I hadn't even thought of this until you just mentioned the scouts. This is a pretty good opportunity for Will Levis, because the big scout games so far haven't really gone great for him. I mean, they won at Florida, but you know, it's not like he set the world on fire. And then he had a rough day against Ole Miss in that loss with some turnovers. So this is, you know, I think Will Levis, based on what I know of him, he's not sitting there worried, oh, I'm going to, you know, try to impress the scouts. But players know when games are big and they want to shine on the biggest stage. And this is a huge stage for both, but particularly for Kentucky. And, you know, Kentucky still has Georgia ahead of them. So, you know, an opportunity for them to make some noise down the stretch. I've been getting, Taylor's been pushing hard on this South Carolina angle. He's all excited about South Carolina. What is your affinity and connection to South Carolina, Taylor?
Well, Reese, I've been to a couple of games in Columbia, I think two or three. Always had a great time. Shout out to Stock and Jurg. I just think they're a nice story. They're 5-2, and I think they're deserving of a winner. And while their resume right now might not be great, they have some opportunities coming up. The next three games are very winnable, and then they close the season with Tennessee at home and Clemson on the road. They could play spoiler in the playoff race. They could get to a 10-win season. You know, there's a lot ahead of them, and I think it's really exciting right now.
So just admit it, Taylor, when you were growing up, you had that like white baseball hat with maroon lettering that said Cox on it, South Carolina, right? Just admit it.
Pete, I have a lot of memories in Columbia, some very good, some very bad. We will not talk about any of them on the podcast, but that's all kind of stuck with me. And I've got a soft spot for the Gamecocks. What can I say?
Columbia is a good little town. I like going to Columbia. And I will say this, I caught the end, Cole Kublik interviewed Shane Beamer at the end of that game on Saturday night. And Shane Beamer, of course, said it's the best environment to watch college football in the country, the best environment, best fan base. It was the typical home and exaggeration. It was an exaggeration. I will say this, when that place is popping, it's loud and it's good. They got those trains in the back. Like when Spurrier had it going, I was there a bunch. And it's a heck of a place to watch a college football game. And much like the Kentucky fan base always showed up through the lean years, the South Carolina fan base in football always showed up through the lean years. So I appreciate that it's clear that a winner is being built there, and that I don't think anyone expected Shane Beamer to turn this thing this quick.
He's done a great job. Shane's one of my favorite guys to work with, and I think he's the quintessential example. I'm not putting him in the Hall of Fame yet or anything like that, but there are some guys who don't really need the lower level job as a head coach to kind of know how to do it. Now, Shane obviously he lived a great example with his dad being a head coach, you know, virtually his entire life. But, you know, he sort of stepped into that role and understands, knows how he wants the program to be run. He's been around good coaches when not only Frank, but also when he was an assistant, you know, at Georgia and Oklahoma and so forth. And he stepped into that role well. I would love to get the show back there. I would love to get back for a game, because what I'm about to say is going to infuriate South Carolina fans. And I don't do this on purpose. I take no pleasure in this. The first time I went there, I was so excited for the entrance. You know, they're big, their 2001 entrance and all, everything that goes with it. And when it happened, I was kind of like, that's it. I've been real excited about this. Why this is it. So I want to give them another opportunity to blow me away with the entrance to start the game at Williams-Brice Stadium, because I kind of was like, yeah, okay, it's fine. And I don't want to feel that way about it, because everybody gets all excited about it. I don't want to be the guy that I talk about all the time, that when you rave about what is that show you watch? Watcher? Is that the show?
The Watcher.
The Watcher. Yeah. I don't want to be that guy that when his friends tell him about the Watcher or tell him that I've got the greatest restaurant, better than all the ones you like on the north end of Boston, I've got a better one for you. I don't want to be the guy that roots against that, you know? And I wasn't rooting against the South Carolina entrance. I want a second chance for me to go, wow, okay. So, you know, maybe we'll get that. But I've got to say, the times I've been there before, and I've called games there on Thursday night. I was there for Spurrier's first game. You know, it was good, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what I had built it up to be or had it built up to me in my mind.
Well, here's what's good, Reese. The 5-2 Gamecocks have Missouri at home Saturday. They'll be favored, winnable game. At Vanderbilt, they'll be favored, winnable game. At Florida, they'll probably be a field goal underdog. And then they close, so they could, in theory, realistically, be 8-2, closing Tennessee and Columbia and at Clemson.
I would that say
could be interesting. You could, yeah, that'd be a heck of an entrance for that Tennessee game if they're sitting there rocking and rolling.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great? I mean, to have that kind of road test. Now that is the one, because it's at home and because of the emotion, that I would give them. They probably have a better chance on paper against Clemson, you know, in terms of matchups, but the venue might favor, if you're going to lean toward an upset, the venue might lean to Tennessee. But I will bet, after enduring what they've endured with this great Dabo dynasty at Clemson, that if you gave them a choice, they go, okay, yeah, it'd be nice to beat Tennessee at home. It'd be a really fun night or afternoon in Williams-Brice Stadium. Give me that win against the Tigers to ruin things for them. I think that's what they would prefer, don't you?
I would think so. What did Dabo say for the Syracuse game? He said, weird things always happen in this game. We sacrifice a billy goat. Did you hear that?
I didn't, but that's out of the Dabo playbook. That's actually pretty funny.
Yeah. And weird things have happened in that game over the years. So I thought that was, entertaining. I would think if I was a South Carolina fan, I'd be ready for, that would be the orange I'd prefer to beat of the final two oranges.
Orange is the color of the season. Wojciechowski did an unbelievable essay on that Saturday. It was really, really good. We sort of beat Texas A&M to death on Monday, and I don't want to go back down that road, but there has been some news and potentially other news from their highly touted recruiting class. From what you've been able to dig up, I don't know how to ask this question other than going, what in the world?
Made some A&M calls yesterday, and look, there's issues there, but this is what was made very clear to me. Anyone who speculates that they're going to choke up the 80 something million to get rid of it, there's zero non-starter conversations. Now, how they change, where they change, where they go, we've spent a bunch of time talking about that. Pollock had some thoughts earlier in the season. That's all real, and that's all on the table. Sometimes when finances enter recruiting, which I think it's fair to say legally has happened at Texas A&M, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, decisions aren't made on fit.
Yeah.
And there have been some interesting fits there at Texas A&M, which has resulted in now the second wave of young players being suspended. And look, that's all part of it, right? Like that is what college athletics are. You get to college, you're probably not ready. You show up. I wasn't ready when I got to college. There was a big learning curve, educationally, socially, et cetera. And they're going through it right now in a very high profile way. In the social media age, they're certainly all getting pounded for losing. So I have some empathy for the kids who are there kind of fighting through this right now. But look, it's a mess. And Jimbo is not hardwired well to handle messes. That's just not who he is. He is not a soothing, calming presence. He just talks faster when things get bad.
If people don't know, they've suspended three players indefinitely. Denver Harris, defensive back. Chris Marshall, I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think Marshall's played a lot. But and then offensive lineman PJ Williams, a couple of those guys are on their second suspension this year. So one, they were in the group that got suspended for the Miami game. So it's messy there. Is it as messy at Miami to Miami as Virginia this weekend, coming off an almost unbelievable 8-turnover game? And a loss to Duke. And, you know, one thing that I didn't really care for that Cristobal said this week was acknowledging, whether directly or indirectly, this idea that the roster was inadequate. And, you know, all coaches are going to say that they want to get their guys in, and I'm sure there's some truth to it, but, you know, they've got good players. But my first question would have been, So Duke's roster was adequate. So Mike Elko walked in there and his roster is adequate enough to blow you out of your own building.
Yours.
Yeah. I mean, come on. You know, yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, what coaches might say behind closed doors is fair game, because we all do it in all walks of life. We complain about this, that, or the other things we want to change, whatever it might be. But publicly, man, just wear that. If somebody asks you that question, say, look, we're going to try to get the best players that we can possibly get in here, but we believe in the players we've got now. And we're going to try to make them their best. We weren't at our best. We were terrible today. Can't turn the ball over 8 times. Not going to win that way. We're going to play better. It's probably true, but you gotta wear one. Every now and then, man, when the fastball rides in on you, you just got to turn your hip into it and wear it. At least for that particular little exchange, which, I don't want to overly exaggerate it, but for that little exchange, I was like, come on, man, just wear it. Just wear it. But
let's say this, like, one of the areas that's been weak there is the offensive line, right? And a lot of times when you take over, some type of rebuild, and I don't think the roster was destitute. If you go back and look at how Manny Diaz recruited, I think he recruited fine, right? Certainly recruited better than Duke did. So, yeah. But if you're Mario Cristobal, who's an offensive line coach, you have your Alex Mirabal, who's your sort of longtime buddy offensive line coach, and you give up 6 sacks to Duke, how much of that is the players and how much of that is the scheme? When you turn the ball over 8 times, now obviously some of that was after Tyler Van Dyke got hurt and Jake Garcia went in the game. Garcia had 3 interceptions, which led maybe a closer game to being the 45-21 game. Duke scored 21 unanswered in the fourth quarter. So I certainly think that, they're probably, no job's perfect when you take it over, right? So in that sense, but that at this moment, if I'm Mario Cristobal, I'm worried about Tyler Van Dyke going and getting $1 million from somebody else to go play quarterback, because you have not given him a good scheme to thrive. He thrived in the scheme last year and he has failed in it this year. It's very simple, right? He thrived and looked like, somebody who could be a first round NFL draft pick. No, he's been banged up and it hasn't been perfect. They don't have a ton of skill around him, but there has been a significant regression. And some of that you have to look in the mirror and say, I did not accommodate this very talented player to the point where he is. And some of that, you just have to look in the mirror and say, I failed as a coach. And I think there has to be some of that ownership right now. Deflecting it to me is not a good sign of leadership there. I mean, there is just, look, Duke was the laughingstock of the ACC last year. They not only lost all their ACC games, they lost them all by an outlandish average score. I did the math at ACC Media Day this year, but they were 3 scores worse than the rest of the league. Mm-hmm. And now they're 3 scores better. So I credit Mike Elko. Mike Elko should be the ACC coach of the year, and he should be in contention for some. Now, I think Josh Heupel may win national coach of the year and rightfully so.
You think that one's over, do you?
Yeah, I mean, boy. Yeah.
Close to it.
I don't know if it's over, but Jalen Hyatt's behind the defense wide open. Yeah. but just Mike Elko deserves a tremendous amount of credit. It's interesting that some of these coaches, just the guys who come in and are really sturdy and have kind of been some of the stories of this season, are FCS guys and then guys who've been on the defensive side of the ball. Everybody wants the shiny new Lincoln Riley. But when you go through and you look at Willie Fritz, who's had an unbelievable renaissance at Tulane, flipping him from 2-10, you look at Lance Leipold coming in and resuscitating Kansas from the dead. Now, both those guys were, had significant experience winning big at lower levels. Mike Elko was, he started at Merchant Marine Academy, probably down the road from you in Connecticut there, right, Reese? And, won at Hofstra as a coordinator, Richmond as a coordinator, and went through. So just because you are an Alabama GA and then a position coach and then a coordinator and have a ton of success with the best players, that is not always the best indicator of success. And when you go through and look through, Wake Forest is number 11 in the country, and credit to Dave Clawson, because we're not even like awed by that anymore. But like Wake Forest, one of the worst jobs in all of the Power Five, is number 11 in the country. Well, Clawson cut his teeth at Fordham and Richmond, before he went. So there's just different ways to, you know, skin a cat, if you will, proverbially. Obviously, you got Chip sitting there with UCLA in the top 15. You know, everybody remembers all his NFL stuff, but he was at New Hampshire as a coordinator for like a decade and a half. He didn't have a cup of coffee there. He had like a lifetime there. So there's different ways to kind of learn and grow. Climbing at K-State, they've been a great story this year. There's another example. I'm not gonna read the top 25 off, but as all these athletic directors are sitting there, I think there's seven jobs open right now, Reese.
Mm-hmm.
And you evaluate and you want to go after the shiny new toy. There's always like a, hey, let's sit back and like find the guy who's really gone and won big. And
yeah.
Figured out ways to do it, manage rosters, manage people, manage adversity, overcome a losing season. There's a power to, you know, there's a power to losing in what you learn from it. Shoot, Josh Heupel was fired and he went to Utah State as a coordinator. But before he left. And look, when you think about Josh Heupel, how good is he an evaluator of quarterbacks? Like how did he find the skills in Hendon Hooker that nobody else saw that Justin Fuente couldn't maximize? Well, he found Jordan Love, who had like an offer from Sac State, you know, in California, recruited him to Utah State, never coached him because he left. Like Josh Heupel kind of knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Almost had a chance to coach Adrian Martinez too, because on among the various places that Adrian committed to, and then the coach either left or got fired, was I believe when Heupel was the OC at Missouri. And so, you know, he's had a way of finding guys. So it's a great point. Duke was very high on getting Elko. That was a big win for them. And, you know, I don't know how many more games the Blue Devils will win this year, but I do know this. When you play Duke, you better put on your big boy pants because they're gonna be ready to play. Pete, not to be that annoying, nitpicky guy, but just, and this is really just as a service to keep Dave Clawson from blowing up your phone. Technically, Wake Forest is tied with USC for the 10th spot in the AP poll. Either way, point well taken. As always, about the Demon Deacons. So that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast. You know what's coming on Friday. Picks. Things that you can make money on, not by listening to us, but by picking against us. That would prove to be very profitable based on the struggling first half of the season that Pete, Bill Connolly, and I have. We appreciate you listening. Ask you to continue to download this podcast wherever it is you like to get podcasts. College Game Day on its way to Jackson for Southern and Jackson State this weekend. We'll be back with picks on Friday. See you next time.